Welcome to the podcast, One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings, episode number 21. I'm your host, Andrew Tertis, here with my co-host, Michael Unterberg. Welcome home, Michael.
Thanks, Andrew. How's it going?
Going very well. It's good to sit with you. And how are you doing?
I am doing well. In the interim between our recordings of podcasts, I became a grandfather.
Mazal tov.
Thank you. This has been
very good news for all of us.
It is very exciting.
Yeah, so in addition to regular comments after the show, we'll be receiving any mazal tovs on the site for...
Yeah, I mean, we're so desperate for listeners. I'm resorting to creating new humans.
Yeah, we might even do a podcast on grandfatherhood and granddaughterhood and everything.
Yeah.
Actually, speaking of birth, let's talk about the matriarch Sarah.
Hmm.
This is in our Matriarchs and Patriarchs portrait series here.
Yeah, I thought it was a great idea that you had of looking at different biblical personalities and seeing maybe we'll sometimes try to fix them to certain times of year, but in general, I think it's just a nice opportunity.
I've enjoyed thinking about Sarah, who began as Sarai. It's often translated as princess and was considered the local princess. I want to give a little more introduction of some of my thoughts, kind of far-reaching, and mm-hmm. to then get into some discussion about it. On one hand, Sarah lived a charmed, unique life as a matriarch. What I mean by that is, as Abraham was called for Lech Lecha, to go out, Sarah did too. Even though we don't know that part of her internal process, she did leave the land of her family, and she didn't only follow Avram, she was very much her own person. She was strong and beautiful. She was desired by kings and known for her beauty and also her generosity of her hospitality. It was always known that kind of the tent was open both on Avram's side, but also Sarah. She taught the women. She welcomed women into the monotheistic perspective.
Now, that's not in the text.
Okay.
Right.
Yes.
That's midrashic.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say a few more things, and then mm-hmm. Before I ask you to jump wherever you want. On the other hand, so I want to contradict a little bit about the charmed and unique mm-hmm. kind of powerful stance. That there's also the very human side where she struggles with humanity, her own humanity and that of being a human, in the sense that she really suffered being barren far into her old age, and she and Avram actually took on a servant, Hagar, who in Midrash is considered to be the daughter of one of the kings who actually desired her, and that in the suffering of being barren, that she had asked Avram to have a child with Hagar, that she considered hopes that it would then be her child, but then she suffers with how that isn't really the case. There is a child, Ishmael, but it doesn't ever feel really hers. And then once she has this amazing birth, then as Yitzchak grows, then she suffers with considering of all the tension of what's happening, and there's lots to say, we'll get into it later, about Ishmael and Hagar. So then she sends out Hagar. Then there's this whole picture of Sarah also having many, many large or intense periods of suffering.
And they're struggle.
And there's very different reasons for that. So I'm wondering, you know, one question comes up to begin with is, if there's a choice here, or are we being directed to be more awed by who Sarah is in how she steps out and is really a leader of women, a teacher, and a guide, or being really feeling connected to her as a human and the kind of the success of her in her realness, you know,
well,
the ups and downs.
So let's take a step back for a second and just when we talk about biblical personalities. So first of all, obviously our source is the Bible. And in this case, it's from the first book of the Bible, from Bereshit, Genesis. And it's a very unique book in ancient Near Eastern culture. if you look at it, and whether you're looking at the book as the divine word of God handed down to Moses at Sinai, or if you're looking at it as a collection of writings from the Hebrews over centuries, edited and redacted, however you look at it, as a form of literature, it is unique in many regards. One of the things that makes it unique, telling stories of matriarchs and patriarchs, even to use more comic booky language, you know, origin stories of where your people came from, are perfectly common in the ancient Near East. Ones that tell complicated stories that are not just focused on making you awe their unbelievable greatness, that they don't have. Their forefathers, their foremothers, which is also unusual to deal with the female characters in other literature, but they tell these sort of they remind me a little more of Rudyard Kipling Just So stories. They're retrofit explanations for why we are a great people, because our forefathers. And what the Torah tells us is sort of a warts and all, very human. We see ourselves in it. So I think the awe aspect that you're talking about in describing a patriarch or matriarch is to be expected in the literature of that age.
Right.
It's the human that's the surprise. So when you're asking a hard question, which is the primary association, and I don't know exactly really how to. I think that's almost a personal choice. What?
Okay. Well, I pose it. We if you have more thoughts later, or if I do, we can return to it. We can get more into some of the specifics of the actual story. I mean, yeah. I know I brushed over the right. details.
You'll see, for instance, in the ultra Orthodox community, there's more focus on the awe aspect, whereas in other communities, there's more of a trying to come to terms with the actual personality, the human, the flesh and blood. And there's a whole spectrum across, and then people sort of choose their way to look at it. I also want to, as long as I'm in step back caveat mode, when I said to you earlier, that's not in the text, that's a midrash. Midrash is, of course, also a text. When I say not in the text, when you're dealing with a biblical character, the source material is the Bible. And what happened was, when you seal a canon, your people's great classic works of literature, when that's closed, which eventually happens to the Bible, somewhere probably in the Second Temple period, whatever, post-Second Temple actually, there's nothing left to add to the Bible. The Bible is now the classic literature of our people. So what do you do if you're a rabbi in the rabbinic age and you have a creative literary impulse? What do you do? So what you do is you write literature about the classics.
Or like a simple temple, Second Temple period mystery. Maybe we just haven't found this yet.
You never know. But the literary output will be looking into the open spaces, filling them out, reinterpretations. I think of it in English literature sort of as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, a play about an aspect of something within the canon of classics.
Right.
And, you know, you have Wicked, exploring aspects of The Wizard of Oz that haven't been really tapped into. But why would those authors choose to go back to those classics and try to fill in their gaps when they could create their own work from whole cloth? So I think there's a number of reasons to do that. You're entering, there's a shared cultural touchstone. We all know about following the Yellow Brick Road, and so there's so much work that the writer doesn't have to do for us to enter into that world.
Right.
With that author. So there's also...
Well, it's interesting because in this modern literature and show business you're talking about, there's a risk because you're dealing with something that not only that is so well known, the quality is so high.
Right.
And the world is so well rendered that someone could crash and burn so easily.
Sure.
If they don't bring it up enough.
Well, you don't want it to look like fan fiction. which is another, you know, fan fiction is all over the internet. It's people who create, fill in more stories. They take the stories further than the author did, but it's not. Well, I don't want to be mean to fan fiction writers. It's rarely. I do think it's fair to say that fan fiction doesn't always rise to the level of literary merit that the source material does. But in the case of the rabbis, they had another problem, that it was, in addition to those literary goals, it seemed too audacious. Everything that needs to be written has been written. Now, obviously, that's not true. But at the close of the Bible, you can understand that cultural force of, who do you think you are writing another book?
It's so interesting. I'm sitting here, I'm having this strong emotional reaction to this idea of it's closed. Because mm-hmm. I am constantly thinking about story and continuation of story or a new story. And once I tried to write, I started writing a sequel to Contact, Carl Sagan's mm-hmm. book. But really it's a screenplay. And was told by someone who's a good friend who's in the movie business, said, you're never going to get the copyright to actually use mm-hmm. the story.
It's closed.
Right. And I just remember the pain of that. So to think about going back to the rabbis, the early rabbis, and they had to really do something, because there hadn't been closed canons before in Judaism. You know, this is a new aspect. Right.
And they had their cake and ate it too by respecting the closure and creating new stuff. Now that new stuff is definitionally interpretive, because what you say about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern now affects how they appear in Hamlet, or The Wicked Witch. You now, when you read the original Wizard of Oz, you now see her differently than you would have otherwise. So I think it's important to understand Frank Baum's Wicked Witch before you understand the novel Wicked, and understand it at those layers. So the biblical Sarah, in the little bit that we have of her in the Bible, I think has to be drawn out, if not before, then at least in addition to and separately from the rabbinic literary output about her.
Okay, does she appear before, what appears of her before she and Avram actually arrive, say, in Egypt, or before the first king?
Well, she's mentioned, it's funny, because the trip to Canaan, there's this entourage, Avraham's father, the patriarch of that tribe, decides to move from Ur Kasdim, which is in Iraq, southern Iraq, I think. They move up to Haran, which is on the Syrian-Turkish border, and they're planning to move down into Canaan. Now, they're clearly a family. They're somewhat nomadic. They clearly deal, and you see it from the rest of the stories of the forefathers, they're dealing with buying and selling. They're merchants. They have, you see when they give a gift or receive a gift, there's precious metals, there's spices, certainly animals. Their main work seems to be their herders. And for whatever reason, the entourage stops there instead of continuing to Canaan. And then God tells Abraham to continue down on his own to Canaan. Sarah's in the entourage. She's somehow related to Abraham, although it's not entirely clear. She seems to be perhaps his niece, his brother's daughter. But she's from the family.
Which name is given to her at this point? Is this Sarai, well, or is it?
It's the Sarai stories right until the circumcision covenant.
But what about the name Yiska? This is the name, is not in the actual text of the Torah.
Not in the text.
So that's in the Midrash.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you're right. And, you know, they become larger than life. You also have this midrashic thing of conserving characters. When we have names, we like to say they're the same person, midrashically. We like to bring, sort of condense the number of players for, I'm not sure what the literary reasons are for that, but very often if you have other names, they'll sort of make them the same person.
Okay, so let's go with Sarah here, or Sarai, in her, where she appears in Torah, and so they're on the route to Canaan, and there's some different stops along the way.
Well, once they get to Canaan, and it says, and they bring their property, and Lot, who appears to be a cousin, goes with them, and then it says, "V'hanefesh asher asu b'Charan," the souls that they made in Haran, which is a very odd turn of phrase. People, I mean, souls like, you know, in English we say 700 souls went down with the ship on the Titanic. It means people, the people that they made in Haran. That's a very awkward phrase. And presumably it means servants that they acquired in Haran. But the rabbis say that can't be what it means. It means that they were already preaching monotheism, and since they were already preaching monotheism, so that's when the rabbis say Abraham, who then is Avram, taught the men, and Sarah, who then is Sarai, taught the women. That's where that comes from. It's a reading into that awkward wording.
So instead of servants, they're looking at it as, in a way, proselytes.
Right, right. And then they don't know really, which of course creates a new question, which is, well, then what happened to them? You have all these monotheists, right, you know, in the cradle of civilization, where'd they go? But what the rabbis are really struggling with, I think, is not the awkward wording of the text. That's their way in. That's the crack in the text. What they're really struggling is, who are these people? It's a family. We've just gone through from Noah till Abraham, this long lineage. And then we get to the family of Terah, who's Avram's father. And they go off on their little journey. And then God says, Abraham, I'm choosing you and a land, and I want you together. I want you and this land to come together, and I want a great people to come out of you, and they will be in this land. Where'd that come from? Where'd he come from? Where'd the land come from? Where'd she come from? I mean, they're just people, as far as we could tell. They're not given adjectives. They're not, their behavior. So the rabbis are trying to look for, who the heck are these people? They must be pretty awesome. And so this phrase of the people that they made in Haran, oh, so that must mean that they were preaching monotheism, bringing people closer to ethical monotheism. That must be who they were. And so God says, oh, okay, great. Now I have candidates to create this nation that will be a beacon of ethical monotheism to the world.
Right. Okay, and on their way, Avram asks Sarah to quietly make believe she's his sister, and they go into a kingdom, and because he's certain that
there's a famine in Canaan. They settle in Canaan, and then Canaan, of course, is weather dependent. We're, you know, Israel today, we're very rain dependent. We don't have great water sources, depending on where you are in Israel. And once there was a famine in this region, so he had to travel to a water secure region, which very rarely had famine. And that was Egypt, because the Nile floods its delta, and the crops just grow. Right. So he has to go to Egypt. So once he has to go to Egypt, he's very worried that the Egyptians are going to kill him to take his wife. So he prevails upon her to not admit to being his wife, to claim to being his sister. Yeah, it's a very strange story.
Right, and there's midrash about that she's so beautiful that everyone in comparison to her are monkeys, which, you know, for me, that's to give someone a compliment so great to then put down everyone else, it degrades the compliment.
Right. Right.
However, it's not the only time where she's considered to be so beautiful that he's in fear.
Yeah, it happens again later with Melchizedek in the next a few chapters later. He has to go into quote-unquote foreign soil, and so they do this trick twice, and it doesn't really work well either time. She is immediately scooped up, and then the...
Right, but he's not killed, and he becomes very wealthy.
It worked for him.
Right.
Right.
Now, I read a midrash where after they left, I believe the second time, that because... as a gift to Sarah, that she was given Goshen, uh-huh. And that ultimately, so many generations later, uh-huh. with
that would be the first time with Egypt, not Gerar. The first one would be right.
Right. So.
Right. And Nachmanides points out that there's all these parallels in the stories that. The pharaoh orders are taken to, I suppose, his harem. And then there's these plagues, the people get sick. And he has his diviners figure out why. And it's because you took this married woman. And he gives her back to her husband and says, why did you set me up like this? Why weren't you straight with me? And he said, I just didn't know. I didn't know that I could rely on civilized practice in this region. And he says, well, get out of here and I'm going to give you all this, I'm going to pay you to leave, essentially.
Right.
And he pays. Handsome. So there's all these parallels of Hebrews coming into Egypt and things start off well and then they turn and then there's plagues the Egyptians and the Egyptians pay them and they leave.
Handsomely.
Handsomely. Well, so Nachmanides says, look at that. It's you're setting, when we say that that our forefathers are our models, Nachmanides says it doesn't just mean that they're people to put on a pedestal to venerate and try to imitate. He says what Abraham and Sarah do actually creates like a DNA strand for Jewish history. And so when Jewish history continues, it's going to like keep following from that. It's a genetic historical, it's an interesting historiography that their behavior, he says, now encodes the unfolding of the future, which then returns to those patterns. So that the Exodus story is a recapitulation of the Abraham-Sarah story.
Which is this particular gift of Goshen, which we learn after the Israelites leave from slavery, and then, beforehand, when Yaakov is invited down by Yosef and by Paro to actually come and settle in the land of Goshen.
Right.
So that this is the place that's really a rich place to raise animals.
Right.
Which is, you know, what the Egyptians
Yeah, Pharaoh does not want shepherds living around the capital.
But this is such an interesting tie to me to think that it was the template, the pre-gift was already mm-hmm. made to Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing we talk about when we talk about Machpelah and Avram buying this giant cave near Hebron after Sarah dies, that it's so obvious, it's very, all the dialogue is spoken out between him and this landsman where the purchase is made and it's official with witnesses so that this is a place that will be Jewish. So it's interesting. We don't have that in the text about Goshen, but it's interesting. It's an important mm-hmm. part of the story,
right? Well, but of course that does remain Hebrew land. But by the way, the reason you're talking about that land sale in Hebron to what's his name, Ephron Hachiti, it's an interesting question, by the way, what a Hittite is doing there?
Why?
Because the Hittites are from Anatolia. They're from what's today Turkey. But they had a huge empire late Bronze Age. So it's very likely that there was a Hittite neighborhood or many Hittite neighborhoods in Canaan because they lived. It's a little bit like saying I mean, maybe this is not the correct scale, but it would be like saying an English speaker, that the English, because the British Empire went throughout the world, there are English speakers everywhere. So if you were a Hittite, odds are pretty good you could find Hittites in lots of places. So it's just funny that in Canaan you have all these Hittites. But that's totally not germane to that. But it's one of the things I find interesting, and I think it is relevant to understanding Abraham and Sarah, is that in the entire story of land sale, when Abraham buys the land from Ephron, nobody signs a document. The citizens of the city are called, and it's publicly announced, and everybody now knows that it's handed over, and this is the land of Abraham, and everyone agrees, and they sit down, and, you know. It's all very public, so that there's multiple witnesses, so that as things move forward, it's in the communal memory. What we do today for that is we sign a contract, so that if issues arise, we pull out a piece of paper.
We sign a contract, but still with witnesses.
Nobody. Correct. You have to notarize it to make sure it's a good copy. But now you never have to call back the notary.
Right.
Because the paper now is the evidence. So why in Hebron do Abraham and Ephron not use writing? Because it's the Bronze Age. They couldn't write.
Hmm.
Writing was still... It had already begun to become part of something business people did a bit, business record, but it had mostly been for royal record keeping.
With chiseling? How was it done then?
I mean, the history of writing is interesting. It starts with pictographs and then eventually cuneiform and hieroglyphics until the alphabet arises.
But this is far before ink.
Oh. Yeah, at this point, I don't know if they have any sort of ink. They're definitely, like Gilgamesh and all that, Mesopotamian and Egyptian stuff is carved. Is there ink? I don't know. I don't know when the Egyptians came up with papyrus.
Okay, so what strikes you where's their tension or where's the inspiration in this story at this point or soon with Sarah?
Oh, well, it's a horrible story. I mean, it's so upsetting. there's nothing really inspirational. It just seems like it seems so cavalier at first blush, certainly of Abraham, to essentially say to her, look, if she's so beautiful, she's going to be taken to the king's harem. And if she's married, they'll kill the husband. And if she's not married, then they won't kill the husband. But she's still being taken to the harem.
Right.
So I think it would be way too strong to say that, you know, she's prostituting herself. They need food. They're desperate to eat. And they're going to live in this land, and whatever they have to do to survive, they're going to do. It's a deeply troubling story. And I would say... Well, at first blush, you might say that Abraham is treating her like a Bronze Age wife, as chattel. But he asks her permission, which I think must be odd. You don't ask... I'm always amazed that this Bronze Age Near Eastern story, at how much respect he has for Sarah. For example, he's a wealthy man, Abraham. Sarah, who he's married to, and let's leave the numbers in the Bible aside, they're getting on in years. It's problematic that they don't have children, and it's something that bothers him deeply, Abraham. He speaks to God about it many times, and God's constantly telling him, don't worry, you're going to have descendants. Very understandable in the culture. He's married to one woman, and she's barren. And in the mindset of the time, as a wealthy merchant, you have options. One of them is getting rid of her. Another is getting some more wives. And he doesn't.
Is it mostly out of love or out of this new monotheistic? Is there a relationship here to...
I mean, if it was monotheistic...
No, then Yaakov would have...
Yeah.
No, okay.
They don't seem to have a problem with polygamy. And as you go further into the Bible, there is... Jews don't officially have a problem with polygamy until in Ashkenaz, around the 10th century of the Common Era. So that's what? That's... You're talking literally thousands of years. Let's say if you say Abraham's 1800 BCE, so you're talking close to 3,000... No, yeah. Years
okay,
later.
So then you're pointing to a...
He seems to love her. He seems to be a partner with her. He doesn't... Imurna achatiat. Can you please say that you are my sister?
So, based on what you're saying, then there might even be some humiliation that he can't just go in and protect her.
Yeah. But it's a terrible story. And we very hard for us as 21st century Westerners to understand the dynamics in a story like that. That probably in that culture makes perfect sense. Like that's just what you do to survive in that world. But it's the gentle nature of, could you please tell them you're my sister? I see how beautiful you are, and I'm afraid they're going to kill me. Could you please tell them you're my sister?
Right.
That there's a gentleness to that that could come from humiliation, but again, I think if you look at the broader story, you see love. He never even asks for a surrogate child. She suggests
right. You know,
surrogacy.
While you're saying this, what's coming to mind is, I wonder why the narrative doesn't have Avram plead with God for...
Yeah, that's fascinating.
For some other solution than to enter into such a dangerous situation.
Nachmanides says it was a sin. That if God said to go to Canaan, you go to Canaan. Now you're starving. Okay, Nachmanides essentially argues, we haven't seen you exhausting your options before entering into this dangerous situation, and it implies, he says, a lack of faith on Abraham's part.
Interesting.
Which I feel that's a rather audacious interpretation, but I see where he's coming from. Yeah, it's rough.
So what's the motivation for the second time of going?
Again, just the lack of resources. So okay. We're going to, this time not to Egypt, to Gerar, which is, if anything, more of a civilized city than Egypt. So he's really offended, you know. How could you think that I'm...
Or the king.
Yeah, and Abraham says, I didn't realize that you guys were more upright than that.
So, you know, you were questioning the validity of whether Sarah, just for convenience sake, was being linked with the name Yiska. Why, in Midrash Rabbah, it said that Sarah had even greater vision, was able to see more than Avram.
Well, that's again, there's this interesting... you can almost, I don't know if, maybe that's too strong, you can often find the rabbinic entryway into the text. When, after the second incident, now I guess we're jumping ahead in the story, so Sarah sets up this surrogate mother, Hagar, who's her handmaiden, and Abraham, and that's what it is, explicitly, Abraham... She says, maybe if you conceive with her, it'll be like I have a child. So she does conceive Abraham's child. And this, of course, creates this tense environment. And she's...
Well, because Hagar starts treating Sarah poorly.
Somehow, and we don't get the details, but somehow she looks down at Sarah and she's treating her poorly. And Sarah complains to Avram, and Avram says, I don't know what you want me to do. I mean, this is your handmaid, this is your idea. Whatever you do is your business. So she drives her out. She causes her so much suffering. Sarah causes Hagar so much suffering that Hagar, pregnant, runs off into the wilderness.
Right. I think the term that's used in English is afflict, that she afflicts Hagar.
Yeah. Inui.
And which is the term related to the Paro and his taskmasters of how they afflict the Israelites, in my understanding.
Yeah. Te'aneha Sara, she caused her to suffer. It's affliction. It is affliction. We use it also on Yom Kippur. The Bible uses the same word, that this is a day of affliction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's terrible. And Nachmanides, again, with his sort of historical DNA theory, says that the repercussion of this affliction, it's a chilling thing to say. He says our father and mother sinned in this treatment of Hagar, and the repercussion is that her child, Ishmael, will cause their children to suffer over the centuries.
That's a long punishment.
That's a chilling assessment by Nachmanides. Again, he has these very bold...
Well, you have reads. A good title for a potential book, Professor. Historical DNA. That sounds like a good one.
I thought you were going to say The Afflictions of Hagar.
Mm-hmm.
But the second time... then the child is born, and then Sarah sees that... This is years later, after Sarah herself has... her son Yitzchak, and she doesn't like the way Yishmael's treating Yitzchak, and she says to Abraham, you have to send her off. And he's contemplating that, sending away his son with that son's surrogate mother, and God comes to Abraham and says, listen to your wife. She knows. So I assume that, in other words, that I think is the source of that rabbinic, that she saw things that he couldn't.
Okay. Well, right close to what you're saying about sending Hagar away because of what's going on, of the relationship with Ishmael and Yitzchak, that an author, I can't see or find her first name, but Cates, I read that she sees Ishmael mitzachek, and that as if she's actually taking on the identity of Isaac, like that the inheritor
Ishmael is taking.
Yeah, that so I've read before that people don't like, maybe he's being a bad influence, he's like kind of
mocking.
Taunting or mocking, but this play with the same root of the word for laugh and for Yitzchak, and
that, yeah, the word keeps coming up with that, in all the Isaac
that
stories,
in a way that she says Ishmael was Yitzchaking. He was actually being who Yitzchak needed to be, and that there was no space for Yitzchak to be it, so therefore had to send him out, which I found interesting.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
There's an author, Ruth Behar, wrote a piece called Sarah and Hagar, The Heel Prints Upon Their Faces. It's a feminist work where wrestling with how troubling it is that these two women... who are both have their suffering, you know, Sarah for being barren and all that, and then Hagar because she's not with her people, she's isolated, and then she's enrolled as surrogate, and there's all this tension, so that where the Behar is pointing to that the feminist vision would be that they would find a way to actually boost each other up.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they actually put heel prints on each other's faces. And there's a few things... a question that she asks is, what does even this feminist question have to do with the Jewish people? And that this comes up, their story comes up on Rosh Hashanah. And why are we looking at this story at that particular time? And what her response is, that it's central, that actually this feminist question is central to the Jewish concerns because this leads to Isaac and then to Jacob and the Jewish people. But also, because there's a question of if Hagar was sent out and that she's not of the Jewish people, and the story's about the Jewish people, why do we start the year looking at this person and who has been afflicted by our matriarch? So that there's almost like a shadow aspect, and that there's an important part, and that's part of our wrestling on Rosh Hashanah, of actually looking inside and seeing that part of ourselves that we're the freed slave, but we're also the slave master. Sarah and Avram actually had this slave, and with a certain idea of how this would be a surrogate child, you know, but that it wasn't how we thought, but mm-hmm. that we have a role and that we have a tikkun to me. We actually have something to work on, and that there's some way to see, as we see, a couple of things that she said is, one is that Hagar may have never seen the pain and conflict that Sarah had. And that's where she mocked her master, you know. But that Sarah really never understood Hagar's situation and what being a single mother, cast out, and even almost having to sacrifice her son. I mean, she actually puts Ishmael near a well. Then it's an angel that comes and says, no, you know, God will take care, and your son will actually give
birth.
That's
the second incident.
Second, right. So, but in a sense that there's a potential sisterhood, now nearly, maybe impossible, who knows, but just the idea that neither really understood the other's suffering and neither really found a way to really boost the other up. And that this story and us looking at it, yes, we're focused on Sarah, and that's who we're talking about. And then, but that Hagar is this shadow, we have to look at how we are in both cases, and looking at what hasn't been appreciated. And
that, well, I would argue that goes beyond issues of feminism. That lack of empathy is the ultimate source for looking at life as a zero sum game, as competitive rather than cooperative, which is really right. Sort of what the 3 weeks that we're in now that Tisha B'Av is dealing with, which is you have to stop dealing with everyone else as your competition and look at how it's not a zero-sum game. Everybody, a rising tide raises all boats, and you have to look at things collectively.
Can you say more about that, about how this period where, you know, considering the destruction of the temple and in the whole process of the fall and then destruction, like how are you speaking to this?
Well, there's no question that the fall, certainly of the second temple, was directly the result, not metaphysically the result, but historically the result of internal Jewish conflict, of Jews being unable to chart a course for the future through compromise of visions, but through everyone with their shoe on the foot of the other, saying it's my way or not, and I will crush you if you try to stop me from moving forward my way. So with that in place, and then one, at least, or some of the groups deciding to start a revolt against Rome in that process, while these civil wars are going on, it led inexorably to destruction and exile for the Jewish people. And so traditionally, rabbinically, we see the effort to repair the destruction of the Second Temple, which is, of course, the exile we're still in today. The corrective measure for that sinat chinam, of that brother, you know, that fraternal hatred, is, you know, fraternal love and an understanding that we have to have avat chinam.
Is it fraternal hatred, or free hatred in the sense the opposite of free love, or?
Well, not in the 19th century free love.
No, I don't mean like that. But like, when you're saying fraternal, is that an accurate translation of chinam?
Chinam means there's no good reason for it. There's an insufficient reason for it. That the hatred is without an acceptable base. Okay. We have differences, and those differences make us angry at each other. Mm-hmm. And our tribal genetic nature makes us then want to turn on those people. But of course, that has to be overcome.
Okay. So I see, these two powerful possibilities that we're looking at have we fail to fulfill, this idea of the feminist idea of there being this cooperation and this boosting up from a deep place and, you know, going hand in hand that way, and also another parallel one, which is more national or universal.
Yeah, I think that what she's describing as a feminist conflict is a microcosm for a human conflict, probably.
One thing I didn't know, and Bahar points out in her essay, is that the African American community often looks to Hagar as a matriarch, as a mother of, you know, the suffering she went through and how she became mother of nation through Ishmael, and that they name her as the only person, the character in the Bible who actually named God, because God gives names to the different patriarchs, but that she named God. I'm actually not even seeing with what appellation at the moment, but that. And in this naming of God, it gave strength to African Americans in the wilderness, in the sense that when they had nothing at the bottom of what looked to be the bottom, that there was, they could actually go and find and name God, and then from that draw strength and create their nation.
That's cool.
Before we close, there's a couple ideas just like to touch on about Sarah. One is that so she's 90 years old when she, or 91 when she gives birth to Yitzchak. And she's about to nurse, and in a very, very modest way. And Avram, according to Midrash Rabbah, encourages her to do it publicly to show the miracle that God has given her this baby. And also to quiet all the rumors about that this is someone else's child in some way. And that, I'll just read, this is Reb Yehuda says, and I will bless her that she should give thee a son, yea, I will bless her in respect of milk. In the questioning that follows, the milk is clearly linked with Sarah's renewed youth and her incipient fertility. The same connections are made with when Isaac is born. Reb Yehuda expounded, and the Lord remembered Sarah to give her a son, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken to bless her with milk. And this goes on that she ultimately nursed the babies of other noble ladies. Like, that there was so much milk that all these great women,
she could wet nurse all the,
brought their children, and that even further, that whoever came and had their child nursed by her, the children became great. So that was in contrast to the being, you know, quiet and nursing quietly, that this was a testament to.
And you sort of have two different sort of rabbinic themes going through there. You have one of the rabbinic hyperbole of not only that, but of the, you know, like a reverse of get smarts, would you believe, where it always gets smaller. The rabbis are always sort of one-upping the text.
Right.
Well, you thought that was cool, but even. So not only did she give birth and nurse her son, but also this other rabbinic idea of association, that somehow associating with great people in whatever way rubs off, that good people, that those interactions, whether you realize it or not, or how or not, like, why would nursing from Sarah's milk make you a better person? Doesn't matter. Somehow encountering, somebody once said to me, how come there's only three forefathers? Why isn't Yosef one? He said, because he never met Avraham. he was born after Avraham died. And so just being encountering Abraham and Sarah, just having met them, somehow elevated you, made you a better person.
Well, it works for me podcasting with you, so... Anyway, one other quick thing I'll just mention about Sarah, also in Midrash, in Bereshit Rabbah, that for all the days of Sarah, that there was a cloud that was by the tent, which in the desert time periods, that would be very cooling.
That's pretty awesome.
And also that her challah, there was always, that there was a light burning from one Shabbat to the next, and always a blessing in the dough. When she died, that all ended until Rivka was married to Yitzchak and lived in the tent, and that came back.
Right, and that's, I think, I don't know exactly what that midrash is going for, but you certainly notice a theme in it of that feeling that we have of, you know, when the older generation passes, that feeling of loss and what can never be regained. But that somehow by engaging, by cooking their food and running the house in a certain way, and that not only the things that you control, like cooking the recipes as best you can, not only does that keep part of them going, does it maintain this tradition, but even the blessings from above, like clouds that you're not in control of, that by carrying on their legacy, you inherit their blessings. So it's a very rich, that midrash takes at this painful and beautiful transition of Rivka moving into her mother, you know, her deceased mother-in-law's home. It's a beautiful.
It sure is.
It's a pregnant image.
Yeah, well, I think we'll close with that. And for anyone in the listening audience who has a recipe for Sarah's challah or Mandelbrot, you know, please send some our way to celebrate the birth of Michael's granddaughter.
Yeah. Well, also, Sarah cooked all kinds of things with Abraham, right?
You could veal tongue
and...
Thank you, everybody, for listening. It's good to be back. You're listening to the podcast One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings. And the music is brought to you by Jewish blues pioneer Saul Kay.
And don't forget to find us at One Way Or podcast on Twitter and Facebook.
Take care.
Bye.